Today is August 29th. We're going to be covering blood typing and blood information today.
Good. All right, so B positive carries B and Rh antigens. There's actually three antigens we've been working with, A, B, and Rh factor. And so the antigen that we would consider foreign is what? A, good. And so the B positive person will build anti-A antibodies. All right, so in terms of a transfusion, we can safely give B positive what blood types?
Positive,
B negative.
Good.
The catch is, if you are a B blood type, you cannot get any blood type that carries what antigen?
Rh.
A.
Yes, so that excludes type A positive, A negative, AB positive, and AB negative, because we would fight against that A antigen. This always sounds like the start of a bad joke, but, you know, B positive walks in the Red Cross, and they want to know who they can give their blood away to. B positive can, of course, give their own blood to
B
positive and who else?
AB positive.
AB positive, good. Let me just repeat that when you're talking about who you can donate your blood to, who you can give it away to, that blood type has to have seen your antigens. And so since we have antigens B and the Rh factor, that's in fact what we're giving. We're giving the B and the Rh factor to those. So B positive has seen, of course, those two antigens. AB positive has also seen those two antigens. Did you do okay with this if you did at home? Okay, let's try B negative. What antigens does this one carry?
B.
Just B. Good. No Rh factor, right?
Right.
Just going to make an issue out of the drawing here. Because this is an Rh negative blood type, there is no antigen for the negative for the Rh factor. So if I say I'm negative for the Rh factor, there is no antigen associated with my blood cell. So I'm not putting anything on there for the Rh factor because I don't have it, okay? And so the antibodies I could potentially build being a B negative person are what?
Anti-A
and anti-Rh. Transfusion, B negative can receive blood from B negative. That's always the easy part. Who else?
O negative.
Can we get blood from B positive?
No.
Because we don't have the Rh factor, and in fact, we would build anti-Rh antibodies. Yeah. Okay. And then finally, if B negative wants to donate blood and give it away to others, the blood types that can be given to include B negative and
AB positive.
AB negative.
B positive.
Must be B positive.
AB positive.
Good. Doing okay so far? Let's hit AB positive next. This one carries what antigens?
AB and Rh.
AB and Rh, good. And what antibodies might this one build?
None.
Right, so we've got all the antigens there are for these two blood types, so there would be none built. if you're AB positive, you can receive blood from
everybody.
Yeah, so that's kind of a nice place to be. The populations of AB and the general groups of people is actually one of the lowest populations. So, yay, be lucky to be AB, but there's not that many people walking around with AB blood. Something like 40% of the population has type O. So, of course, that's the one that can't receive but just from the O blood type. But this one, which would be the ideal blood type to have, actually can't, you know, is actually not that common in the population. Let's see, if you walk into a blood bank and you've got AB positive blood, the only people that can get your blood are
AB
positive, exactly. So for AB negative, we still have the A antigen and the B antigen. This person would build an antibody against
anti-orange.
So even less common in the population is AB negative. This blood type can receive blood from
A negative.
So we can't receive any blood from an Rh positive person because we don't have the Rh, and we would build antibodies, right? So we would fight that foreign blood type. And if you're AB negative, you can donate this blood to
AB positive.
We cannot give AB anything to an A person. Why?
Because
of the B antigen, right? And we can't give AB positive or negative to O because of? Yeah, we've got A and B antigens, and what does O carry?
The A and B antibodies.
A and B antibodies, right. So they would fight against our foreign antigens. You doing okay so far?
Mm-hmm.
Any questions? Anything I can help clear up? All right, let's try O positive next. The only antigen present in O positive blood is, in fact, the Rh factor. This person would build antibodies against two antigens. They are
A and B.
Good. O positive is actually the most common in the population. Around 40% of humans have O positive blood. But it doesn't work very well if you need a transfusion because you can only get it from
O positive or O negative.
But if you walk in the blood bank and donate it, then you can give it to
A positive, B positive, and O positive.
Okay, just to kind of put a kink in the conversation here, O positive blood carries anti-A and anti-B antibodies. If we pull that blood type and give it to the AB positive blood, what is there a small potential for?
Agglutination.
Right, because you're bringing in a small amount of those anti-A and anti-B antibodies. So it's not that the next reaction is going to be any worse. It's just that You know, every time you do this, you're bringing in a small risk for agglutination. And finally, O negative is considered our universal what?
Donor.
Good. Universal donor. That blood cell has no what? Antigens. But it has all
of the antibodies.
Of the antibodies, good.
And it can only receive from itself.
Only can receive from itself. But you can give it to
everybody.
Let's see, we got O negative as a universal donor, and who is the universal recipient?
AB
positive. AB
positive,
good. So just to repeat something we talked about in here in class on Thursday of last week, the antigens are carried on the red blood cell surface. The antibodies are transported in your blood plasma. So there's actually two issues we have to be aware of doing transfusions. We have to be aware of the antigens on the red blood cell surface, and we have to be aware of any potential antibodies being carried in the blood plasma. I wanted to make that point because not all transfusions are whole blood transfusions. Whole blood transfusion means you're getting all the blood cells, the blood plasma, everything. So if you're talking about just getting a blood plasma donation, as may be the case for a burn patient, then you have to then be concerned about your antibodies. If you're talking about just doing red blood cell transfusion, then you know now antigens become more of the issue. But you know, whole blood transfusion, then we got to be alert to antigens on the red blood cells and antibodies in the blood plasma. So I just want to put that out there because you know not all transfusions are the same. They may be portions of the whole blood. How are you feeling about blood typing? Getting there?
Better?
Okay. We've got plenty of time between now and the test, so if we need to revisit this every single day, we can. I can start class with a few questions, and hopefully by the time we get to the test, you'll be good to go. In the past, I have found people get confused on that Rh factor, and the thing to remember is, if you're positive, what can you receive in terms of Rh factor?
Negative.
Positive and negative. But if you're negative, you can receive?
Negative.
Only negative, right. So that I found is a rubbing point, you might say, with the blood types. Okay. That pretty much does it for page 31, and we covered 29 and 30 in class last Thursday. Looks like we're good to go to flip back to page 22. We'll start next class with those blood typing questions. Why don't we just start with the new content today then, which is just basic blood information. Top of page 22 talks to you about blood, but you know, I want to mention lights. Okay.
Actually, while I'm walking, let me go grab the roll. I apparently switched out your roll for the biotube spin, so I'll be right back.
Thank you. So in terms of blood, you know, this is one of those chapters where we're looking at a connective tissue. Pretty much every other system that we cover is actually an organ system. So this is unusual that we cover a tissue type for an entire chapter. All right, so top of page 22 there, blood is in fact our only liquid or fluid connective tissue. And the liquid portion makes up a little more than half. Around 55% of your blood is liquid plasma. Okay? 45% of your blood is formed elements. And what are some examples of formed elements?
Red blood cells.
White blood cells. And platelets. Good. That's it. This is going to be a really important issue for us when we talk about blood pressure in the next few chapters. So let's kind of think about the fact that blood is a little more than half water and a little less than half formed elements or blood cells. If you alter the ratio here of blood plasma to formed elements, then you alter how thick that blood is circulating through your vessels. That's really an important point to think about, because if you're dehydrated, for instance, or if you have a disease like polycythemia, then that can alter how hard your heart has to work in order to circulate that blood. So, you know, we don't necessarily take these numbers lightly. A little more than half of blood is liquid plasma. A little less than half are those formed elements. Okay, let's see. Next thing there talks about how much blood a typical person has. Typical male has around 5 to 6 liters or quarts of blood. Females have a little less at around 4 to 5 liters. Let's just make this simple and say on average, the human body has around 5 liters of blood. So let's just make it simple and say on average, the human body has around 5 liters of blood. Put this in perspective. You'll think about 2-liter bottles, and if you've got a large male, 6 liters is about what we're looking at. A small female may have only 2 of those 2-liter bottles. So when we talk about blood loss and the point of hypovolemia or shock, it doesn't require a whole lot of blood to be lost to get into dangerous territory. Hypovolemia, I did want to mention, is a condition of low blood volume, and that can come from blood loss. We talk about hypovolemic shock a little later when we talk about blood pressure, but that only can come from having just lost 10 to 20% of your blood volume. So that's not an incredible, huge amount of blood. Okay. Let's talk about blood pH. You probably have heard this before. Normal blood pH is basic, between 7.35 and 7.45. We can say, on average, blood pH hovers around 7.4. So the range is 7.35 to 7.45. But we can say, on average, blood pH is around 7.4. So we're all hot-blooded, you know, 100.4 is higher than body temperature. And of course, there's a reason for having blood warmer than body temperature. It helps to circulate the warmth to your vital organs. So 100.4 on average is the temperature for blood. Imagine if blood was actually colder than body temperature, you would be bringing cooling to your vital organs instead of bringing oxygen and warmth to those vital organs. And this is something you probably already knew before stepping foot in here, is that blood is viscous, more viscous than water is. So what does the term viscous mean? It's thicker, yet it flows more slowly than water. So it's a thicker substance than water. Let me put it to you this way. A milkshake is more viscous than water. So it's just a way of saying it's thicker than water. Milkshake, that sounds good. What's that, Kanika?
I thought that we all know single word as blue.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, because you related, then, you know. Milkshake. That sounds good.
Cookies and cream.
That does sound good. Now our stomachs are going to be growling, right? Okay, so blood color can indicate how oxygenated or deoxygenated that blood is. Bright red blood is considered to be oxygenated. It is a bright scarlet red color, while a darker color indicates deoxygenation. What does deoxygenated mean? Yeah, not very oxygenated, right. So blood that has lost its oxygen content has more of a rust color to it. I did want to mention that blood is never blue. Even though it may appear somewhat greenish blue through your skin, it's a trick of the eye. Your eye perceives the melanin in your skin combined with the dark red color of your vessels and somehow perceives that combination as blue. But in reality, blood is never blue. Even if you cut open a vein, it would never be blue. Blood's either bright red or dark red, never blue. Let's talk about functions of blood. Down halfway of your page there, you'll notice that transportation is one major issue. So what kinds of things do we transport in our bloodstream?
Oxygen.
Carbon dioxide.
Hormones.
Waste products. Nutrients. Good. So the good and the bad, the nutrients and the waste products, hit your ride in your bloodstream for transport. Next thing there is regulation. What kinds of things does your blood help regulate?
Body temperature.
Body temperature, good.
pH.
And water, good. And then we already know about the protective functions of blood. It helps to protect us if we've cut a vessel by clotting up that blood. And what else does blood help us protect against? Invaders, yeah. So infection and invaders, we've got white blood cells that can play that role. At the bottom of your page, we're going to talk about what's in a drop of blood. And so we have blood plasma once again and formed elements. Just want to remind you that plasma on average is a little more than half of your blood volume at around 55%. And those formed elements make up a little less than half at around 45% of your blood volume. Let's talk about plasma first. By itself, spun away from those blood cells, blood plasma takes on a straw or a yellowish color. You'll notice in the centrifuged blood tube on the left, the blood plasma floats toward the top, and those heavier blood cells sink to the bottom. So the red coloration of blood actually comes from our red blood cells. Over here on the right-hand side, this looks like a bag of urine, doesn't it? So, I don't know if you came to me and said, we're going to transfuse this. I'd be like, I don't know about that. Wait a minute. Yeah, that yellow blood plasma is actually great for a person who's like a burn patient because it helps to give them a lot of those clotting factors back that they may have lost through a burn. So some people may require just a plasma transfusion. So let's think about what is in blood plasma. Not blood cells, right? Okay, so what is there? Definitely water. Yeah, that's a good one. Definitely nutrients.
Antibodies,
good. Amino acids.
Glucose
and vitamins. Basically the same thing you transport, right? So the good stuff like nutrients and vitamins, the bad stuff like waste products. But of course, we've got oxygen here, we've got CO2 that we could be looking at in our bloodstream. There could be small amounts of those gases in the blood plasma. But really, we're looking at things like clotting proteins and antibodies that may be helpful for someone who has had a burn or a transfusion reaction. I wanted to focus on those plasma proteins for just a moment. They are very important. There's a couple of plasma proteins here that we have never talked about in a course before. One of them is called albumin, or albumin, however you like to say it, and it's made by your liver and contributed to your blood plasma. This protein is very important for maintaining blood pressure. As we talk about maintenance of blood pressure, we'll come back and I'll mention albumin one more time because it's really important for maintenance of blood pressure. If a person has liver problems and cannot make albumin, we then see issues like blood pressure becoming a problem for maintenance. There are globe-shaped
proteins, things like thyroglobulin that transport thyroxine. We've also got antibodies that are round or globe-shaped as well. Those also contribute to blood pressure regulation, and they too are transported in your blood plasma. And you may wonder why blood is considered a connective tissue, because it doesn't really fit the same bill as a lot of the other connective tissues. It is a connective tissue. It does have proteins in it, fibers in it, but the fibers like fibrinogen only appear when we need it to. When should the clotting protein called fibrinogen appear? When you have a cut, yes. That is the only time you should see fibers appear in your bloodstream. You know, I've got this mental image of these long stringy fibers flowing through my blood vessels, but you know, they're in a dissolved state. They're not actually in a materialized state. So the only time you do see these proteins come appear out of the blood is when you need them. All right, so let's talk about the formed elements. They take us to the top of page 23. The most common formed element by far is the red blood cell. Platelets are ranked second most common, and white blood cells are the least common. That sounds like a good test question, doesn't it? In this blood smear, what we're looking at are mostly little pink donuts. These are red blood cells. They have no nucleus, which makes it easy to spot them and differentiate them from the white blood cells. So in this picture, you know, we can just estimate that there's a lot more red blood cells than there are platelets, which are tiny cell fragments. And there's more platelets here than there are white blood cells, only two of them showing up in this picture. So this particular blood smear actually follows what we expect. Most common blood type is red blood cell, and then we've got platelets, and then the least common cell type is white blood cells. So by looking at this picture, you can tell a lot about the red blood cell shape. It is an anucleate cell, which means what?
No nucleus.
No nucleus, right. And you can also tell that they are round in shape, and they look like they have a hollow center. It's not, in fact, a true hollow center like a donut has. Here we are talking about food again. But it's more like a donut that's had the icing stay across the center. We call it a biconcave disc. So the shape of the red blood cell is built around its function, which is to transport oxygen and a little bit of carbon dioxide. Because these cells travel only inside your bloodstream, they have to be flexible. So they are like little frisbees that can flex and bend through the capillaries, and then they flex back out to their normal shape once they emerge. It is important that red blood cells don't use the oxygen that they make, that they use to make ATP. The ATP made here is in fact made anaerobically, which is a process that makes ATP without oxygen. Imagine if your job was to deliver the donuts. Let's talk about food. Your job was to deliver the donuts, and by the time you had made your way to all your stops, you had eaten all the donuts and there was nothing left to deliver. Uh-oh, right? Okay, so imagine if you were a red blood cell and you consumed all your oxygen on your process of taking it to your cells and tissues. Here you are arriving at cells and tissues and there's no oxygen. Your cells say, well, hey, what about me? Oh, I used it all, sorry. Okay, so it is important that we don't consume the oxygen that we're transporting. That's why ATP is made anaerobically. That way we don't consume the oxygen that's being transported. So if you are familiar with making ATP, what organelle typically is involved in that process?
The mitochondria.
Mitochondria, right. So this anaerobic respiration that we're talking about actually doesn't require the mitochondria. Here's some pretty red blood cells. They are biconcave discs. They are flexible, and they do lack a nucleus at maturity. And the anucleate part is important because if you don't have a brain, you can't repair yourself. And if you don't have a brain, you don't really have anything to do to think or process or make proteins. All these red blood cells do is simply ride in your bloodstream for about 4 months, and then they're removed by your spleen. So they are brainless drones that do nothing but transport oxygen and CO2 around your bloodstream. If we want to know how much of your blood volume is made up of red blood cells, we have a value called the hematocrit. This hematocrit value measures how much blood volume is just those red blood cells. So if we look at the normal values there, on average, 45% is the normal range. Earlier today, we talked about how much of your blood is formed elements. Do you recall the number?
45%.
It was 45%. Not a mistake, right? So if 55% of your blood volume is blood plasma, and 45% is formed elements, and 45% is red blood cells, that means you have very few white blood cells and platelets that make up your blood volume. Why do you think males have more red blood cells than females? They have a higher blood volume to begin with. And what hormone do males make that females make less of?
Testosterone,
right. Testosterone actually drives blood formation and muscle formation in males. Muscle requires a great blood supply. Females have less muscle tissue on average, and of course, less muscle tissue means less blood volume. So that's why we see a difference here of around 48% for males and around 38% for females.
Are you going to this blood drive after class?
I'm anemic, so probably not.
Okay.
I've been donating my blood for a while. They like me because O negatives are always
fine. Oh, yeah, they probably would just give you a hug when you walk in. Yeah.
I took enough iron, so hopefully my levels are good, because they denied me one time because it was below 9.
Gotcha. Yeah. I know with the hurricane and all that stuff in Texas, they probably would love to have some blood right now. Yeah.
Sure.
I would love to help. I just would have to lay down for several weeks. Lay down with me. Yeah. So if we centrifuge blood, in other words, if we spin the blood, then the heavy blood cells sink to the bottom and the lightweight plasma floats to the top. And a very thin layer in between the two is called a buffy coat that separates the floating plasma from the sinking red blood cells. What kinds of cells do you find in the buffy coat?
White blood cells.
White blood cells, good. And of course, platelets hang out there as well. But you know, that buffy coat or buffy layer only constitutes around 1% of your whole blood volume or less. So really what our blood is mostly plasma and then red blood cells. That's what we've got. So in this picture, you'll notice the erythrocytes make up 45% of your whole blood volume, and the hematocrit makes up 45% because those two numbers are the same. If we're dehydrated, we may have less fluid in our bloodstream, and our hematocrit may be a higher value. So if we're dehydrated, we may expect to see 55% for our hematocrit. What is the percentage of red blood cells we have then? 55, right. So whatever your hematocrit is the percentage of red blood cells you have and vice versa. Is this a concept that seems pretty straightforward? Okay. So let's talk about hemoglobin, because this is another very important component of our red blood cells. What is hemoglobin responsible for doing?
It transports oxygen.
Transports oxygen, good. Let me take you back to Bio-210 for just a moment. In Bio-210, we talk about protein structure. And proteins can be rather large molecules, like hemoglobin, and they can be rather complex in their structure. What you're looking at is not one protein, but in fact, four polypeptide chains. There are two alpha chains, two beta chains. They've color-coded them for us. You'll notice the two alphas down here on the bottom, the two beta chains up here on the top, and each one of these polypeptide chains has its own heme group, and each heme group has its own what? What's sitting inside that heme group?
Iron.
Iron, yeah. So that is the complex structure of a hemoglobin molecule. Heme, of the word hemoglobin, comes from that heme group that has an iron molecule. And globin comes from those four polypeptide chains. My take-home message today about hemoglobin is the number four. This is like Sesame Street, right? Okay, so the number four is the magic number for your hemoglobin molecule. There are four polypeptide chains. There's four heme groups. There's four iron molecules. And how many total oxygens can you transport by a hemoglobin? Four, good. And by the way, that is your blank about two-thirds of the way down the page. We can transport four molecules of oxygen on a single hemoglobin molecule. Interesting how hemoglobin works. It changes shape to make it easier for more oxygens to ride. The ideal situation is to have four oxygens bound to your hemoglobin. And you'll notice that when we are in a state of deoxyhemoglobin, the molecule kind of shifts itself and says, hey, I got seeds open. Would you like to come for a ride? And it makes itself more, you know, kind of opening. It's, they call it a conformation shift. For oxygen to come and sit on that hemoglobin to go for a ride. So when we have a full ride of four oxygens, then the hemoglobin transports at full capacity. And that's really what we're looking for, is to transport four oxygens at any given time. If you're only transporting one or two oxygens on a given hemoglobin molecule, and you have to suddenly run from a bunch of bees that have come after you, you don't have a reserve supply. So by taking four oxygens on a hemoglobin at any given time, you've got an immediately available reserve supply of oxygen. All right, so we do transport a little carbon dioxide at the very bottom of your page, but it's not going to compete with oxygen for a seat. In fact, it actually rides on a different portion of your hemoglobin molecule, and when it binds those amino acids, we call it carbaminohemoglobin. That just rolls off your tongue. So there is no competition there for carbon dioxide to ride. Let's talk about a little bit more about red blood cells, top of page 24. Do y'all have questions so far? In a drop of blood, which is a very small amount of blood, we are looking at around 4 to 6 million red blood cells on average. Okay, so if you kind of think of scale with me for just a moment, we're normally transporting around, 5 liters of blood, and about half of that is red blood cells. So around 2.5 liters at any given time are red blood cells. And if you think about scaling up one drop to 2.5 liters, you're talking that there are trillions of red blood cells in transport at any given time. They are so important for transporting oxygen for your body. All right, so that's a number to know. 4 to 6 million red blood cells are found in a drop of blood. The drop of blood measurement that we're looking at is called a cubic millimeter. You can abbreviate that as mm with a little 3 superscript. How long do red blood cells live? Good. Why don't they live longer? They can't grow. They can't make new proteins. They are dead in the water because they have no what? No nucleus, yeah. So because they have no nucleus, when they get ragged and worn out, the spleen says, hey, you're looking kind of rough. Why don't you come through here and stay with me? The spleen removes them, and then we take them out of circulation. So that way we don't have ragged, bad blood cells going through our bloodstream.
So people will damage their spleen, like an accident, and mess their spleen up. What do they have to do?
As long as their liver works, and that is kind of like the backup organ for the spleen, so the liver then takes over that role. It does some of the removal of the worn-out blood cells, And so the liver just says, all right, this is now my job. So it now filters out those red blood cells. But yeah, that's kind of a scary thought if the liver then doesn't work.
Yeah.
All right, so about halfway down your page, let's talk about recycling, or actually near the top of your page, recycling red blood cells. When we get rid of damaged, worn out, and ragged red blood cells, we actually don't discard a whole lot of their product. We keep a lot of it so that we can make new red blood cells. So the iron happens to become part of a new red blood cell. That heme group is broken down and becomes bile. So here's an interesting story. The red blood cell that is made by your bone marrow eventually breaks down. The heme group has a second chance at life. It becomes bile. Bile is made by your liver and dumped into your small intestine, where it helps to break down fats. And then, of course, it's discarded in your feces. The brown color of feces actually comes from the breakdown of the heme group. So we give quite a bit of a life to that heme molecule that started back in your bone marrow. The globin chains, those of course are made from amino acids, get recycled into making new proteins. So this is a case of waste not, want not. We pretty much recycle and reuse every part of a red blood cell. What you see discarded is in the urine, you see a little bit of the breakdown of the heme, and in the feces, you see a little bit of the breakdown of the heme. The yellow color of urine and the brown color of feces comes from the breakdown products of our red blood cells. So that tells you how much we're breaking down every single day, if it's enough to color your urine a light yellow color and your feces a brown color. Okay, so since we're constantly recycling red blood cells, let's talk about what it means to make more red blood cells. The process of making any blood cell is called hematopoiesis. We're only going to focus on making red blood cells, but I wanted to give you the background info here. You've probably heard this stuff in Bio-210. Hematopoiesis is making new cells, and where does it take place?
Red bone marrow.
Bone marrow, good. Red marrow or yellow marrow?
Red marrow.
Red marrow, good. And so what we have is kind of the stem cell called a hemocytoblast that gives rise to every blood cell type. And that particular cell is responsible for making all of our blood cells.
That was on the quiz.
That sounds like a good quiz question, yeah. And that seems like a scary amount of responsibility, doesn't it? If your hemocytoblast has problems, like say for instance bone marrow cancer, then that gives problems into all populations of your cells. Red, white, platelets. So, you know, that's kind of a scary amount of responsibility for one stem cell. Just checking to see if anybody needs a screen. Y'all good? You're not sleeping in the dark, are you? I would. Okay, so this is kind of like a family tree, isn't it? There's the ancestor up there at the top. There's that hemocytoblast at the top. And you'll notice how it gives rise to white blood cells, red blood cells, platelets. So, boy, that is a lot of responsibility for that stem cell. Like I said, we're going to focus just on making red blood cells. And this process is called erythropoiesis. And guess what? It's driven by a hormone called erythropoietin. Let's call it EPO for short. So I'll pause. If you guys want to copy down this slide, you're welcome to.
Okay, so we're making red blood cells all the time, every single day. And then if you happen to have a case where there's not enough oxygen being transported, that tells your kidneys to release EPO. So, you know, why are your kidneys the ones who are detecting the low oxygen levels? What do they do to your blood? They filter it, yeah. So they're constantly filtering your blood, and it's a great place for our body to say, hey, there's not enough oxygen in circulation. Why don't we make more red blood cells? And so it's kind of hard for your kidneys to talk to your red bone marrow, but we can do so by way of a hormone. And the hormone's name is EPO. So if you happen to have low oxygen in the bloodstream traveling through the kidneys, that will activate the release of EPO from the kidneys. That's where your EPO is made. It's made in the kidneys. How does EPO get to your bone marrow?
Bloodstream,
right? So that's how we get all those hormones in circulation. It travels from your kidneys to your bone marrow by way of your bloodstream. And then at your bone marrow, there are receptors for EPO. And then we tell those hemocytoblasts, hey, ramp up production of those red blood cells. Different textbooks will give you different days to make a new red blood cell. The textbook that we use says something like 3 to 7 days to make a new red blood cell. Okay, so about a week's time later, you should see an increase in blood cell population. So it's not an immediately available supply. We have to gather the ingredients to make a red blood cell, make the red blood cell, mature it, and then get it out into circulation. So you may know that in sports, there is something called blood doping, and blood doping involves EPO injections. What will EPO injections do to the bone marrow?
Tell
it to make more red blood cells. What is the athletic advantage that somebody's going to get from having more red blood cells?
More oxygen.
More oxygen, right. And the more oxygen you can transport, the more what you can make? More ATP, more muscle tissue, right? So those muscles rely on oxygen to make ATP. So we think that, you know, people who do blood doping with EPO injections are going to get an athletic advantage from those injections.
Lance Armstrong.
What's that? Who's the cyclist? Lance Armstrong, yeah. There's been a lot of them in the cycling world that have doped, yeah. So unfortunately, this does not come without negative side effects. What do you do to that ratio of blood plasma to formed elements if you blood dope?
It's going to go out of balance.
It's going to go out of balance, right. Normally, we see around 55% of your blood is plasma and about 45% is formed elements. How do you change that ratio if you blood dope?
You increase the 45% in formed elements.
You increase the formed elements, right. So let's say that you bump up your formed element population to 60% of your blood, and now your blood plasma only makes 40% of your blood volume. So I want you to kind of think big picture here. What does that do for the viscosity of your blood?
Makes it very thin.
Makes it very thick, right. And in terms of circulating thick blood, it's like circulating sludge, you know, through your bloodstream. What does your heart have to do to circulate this stuff?
Pump harder.
Pump harder, right. So we do see problems like the heart hypertrophies and gets larger. We see issues like polycythemia, heart attack, stroke, and that can be a negative from having had excess red blood cells in circulation.
Good question.
Sure.
Couldn't the blood also like clot in you, or like make blood clots if that were happening?
Maybe, but if you're talking just EPO injections, the only thing it turns on is making more red blood cells.
Okay.
There's actually another hormone, thrombopoietin, for making platelets.
Okay.
So it may not enhance the process of having blood clotting occur directly.
Okay.
So I know you probably can't read the picture on captions here. You'll notice that we start with cells in the bone marrow that have a nucleus. We start with a hemocytoblast that goes through a maturation process, and we eventually end up pushing out into circulation an immature red blood cell that is called a reticulocyte. This reticulocyte is not yet able to transport oxygen. It just floats in your bloodstream for around 2 to 3 days. And at the end of that time, it has matured to the point that it now can pick up and transport oxygen. And at that point, let's now call it what? An erythrocyte, yeah. So this process of taking an immature hemocytoblast, letting it go through the maturation process, is around 3 to 7 days, okay? So there's something I want to point out here about this. If we want to know your up-and-coming population of red blood cells, your up-and-coming population, what cells should we test for in your bloodstream?
APL.
What type of cell?
The
reticulocyte or erythrocyte? Reticulocyte, yeah. Why would the reticulocyte give us an idea of your up-and-coming population? Yeah, they're the immature cells. They're going to be the mature cells in about 3 days. Is there any problem measuring your erythrocyte population to get a stable idea of what's going on in your bloodstream?
They're
going to
be dying.
They're dying, yeah, every single minute, every single hour, right? So if you want an idea of what's going to be the next 2 to 3 days, look at the reticulocyte population. So erythrocytes are constantly dying, constantly being replaced. So I just wanted to mention that in some cases, a reticulocyte population may be the one that's measured. All right. Just wanted to mention a couple of ingredients that we need to make a red blood cell. We know iron is necessary. There's a couple of blanks there for you. We also need vitamin B12 and folic acid. Okay, so we need folic acid and vitamin B12. Animal products. Meat products are the only place you can get B12 from. You cannot get B12 from any plant matter at all. So if you have no animal products in your diet, then the only other way to get it is through a B12 injection. Yeah.
They gave me the pills. When I got sick off of a lot of the meat they were giving me. They gave me B12 and the folic acid pills and iron. I take all of those.
Take all of those. So you just cover your bases in all forms. Yeah. I was taking B12 pills, didn't really feel any different. So they say that you don't absorb a whole lot with the pills, B12 pills, that you get more B12 in your system by injection. So if you need a boost, B12 injections are the better way. And where do you get folic acid from? Yeah, fiber cereals. So go to the grocery store, walk down the cereal aisle, walk down the cracker aisle. They proudly advertise on the front of the box, you know, this is your daily requirement for folic acid. Folic acid is also important for moms in their menstruating years because if a woman can potentially become pregnant, she needs folic acid before the baby's spinal cord forms. So folic acid is not just important for red blood cells, it's also important for making babies' nervous systems grow properly. All right. Let's talk about leukocytes. They are on the top of page 25. What kind of questions do you have so far? So far, so good. Leukocytes are our least common type of blood cell. They fight infections, they fight foreign invaders, they do form antibodies, and so they have to be a little more complex in terms of their anatomy. They do have a nucleus, they have organelles, unlike those red blood cells, and they may or may not have a number of granules in their cytoplasm. It is their job to travel to the site of an infection, so they have a special trick called diapedesis. This means that they can walk across, literally, walk across the lining of your vessels out into your damaged cells and tissues and then fight the infection there. Red blood cells do not have this special trick.
They are only confined to travel where?
In your bloodstream.
In your bloodstream, right. So the only type of cell that we need to be able to migrate to the site of a damage or an infected area is a white blood cell.
They're the only ones with passports.
That's a good way to put it. The only ones with passports, yeah. Notice the populations here are very low. Around 6,000 to 9,000 per cubic millimeter is on average what we expect to see. Go back for just a moment. What was the normal population of a red blood cell count?
4 to 6 million.
Yeah. So we have a 10 to 1 difference between red blood cells and white blood cells. We have 10 times more red blood cells than we do white. The lifespan for these white blood cells may only be a few hours to a few days. Some of them, however, live for years if they're considered to be a memory cell. It just depends on what their function is in the body. It is very hard to generalize about white blood cells because they have quite a variety of roles. Okay, so you guys have seen leukocytes in lab, right? Okay, let's walk through the different kinds of white blood cells. We divide them into two categories, granulocytes and agranulocytes. What's the difference between the two?
Granules,
right. Granulocytes have granules, agranulocytes don't. You'll notice in this picture, the white blood cells that are considered agranulocytes may be on average a little bit bigger than the granulocytes. Lymphocytes and monocytes here on the left-hand side are pretty large cells. The ones on the right-hand side, eosinophils, basophils, and neutrophils, tend to be a little smaller, and they have a strange nucleus shape as well. All right, so let's talk about granulocytes first. These are the phils, the ones that have a phil ending, P-H-I-L. I know you've had vocab back in Bio 210. What does phil mean? Love or attraction. Okay, so these white blood cells love a certain color of stain. So I think of them as your lovers. They love a stain, okay? And so the stain is picked up by granules in the cytoplasm. These particular types of cells have some strange-shaped nucleus. They often don't live very long because their job is to eat and destroy most of the time. And that's how we classify these particular cells as phagocytes. What does phagocyte mean?
They eat.
They eat, yeah. So these are the ones that eat for a living. Okay. Instead of starting these five types, why don't we just put a note that we're going to start here on Thursday, and then that way we can do all five at one sitting. Do y'all have any questions for today? I'll see you on Thursday.